Eastern Jurchen clans, the Wanyan, began to conquer its Jurchen neighbors, the first clear step on the path to nationhood. Some of the Jurchen under attack fled south into Goryeo. Since the days of its founder, Wang Kon, the kingdom of Goryeo had declined to chase after the Song stamp of approval. It had fought its own border wars against the Liao, who made periodic attempts to expand into Goryeon territory, but a great border war in 1018 had shattered the Liao army, and since then the two countries had been more or less at peace. Until now, the nomadic Jurchen to the north had been more of an annoyance than a military threat. The people of the northeast frontier frequently suffered from the Jurchen horsemen who came to invade and rob, remarks the contemporary chronicler Choi Seong-no. To keep them out, the 11th century kings of Goryeo built a long wall that stretched from the mouth of the Yalu River over 300 miles inland. The wall was effective against random wanderers, but it didn't stem the flood of refugees from other Jurchen tribes fleeing from the ambitious Wanyan. When the Wanyan demanded that the refugees be returned, the Goryeon general Yun Kwan led a special army, the Extraordinary Military Corps North, to fight against them. Unlike the regular Goryeon army, which was largely made up of foot soldiers, the Extraordinary Military Corps had a full division of cavalry, which was more effective against the mounted Jurchen. In 1107, the Extraordinary Military Corps pushed its way into Jurchen territory and built a series of defensive positions known as the Nine Forts in order to protect the northern territories. In 1115, the Wanyan clan of the Jurchen came under the rule of a younger brother named Akuta, and their fortunes began to change. Akuta realized the need for ceremonial kingship, for recognition from an established throne, for history, for all the things that, time and time again, had turned wandering nomads into a settled state. Like every other aspiring king on the northern plain, he wanted the Song stamp of approval, but he was willing to work up to it. Instead, he sent a message to the Liao emperor, demanding that the Liao extend the formal recognition that Akuta was a great holy and enlightened emperor. He wanted his clan to be known from now on by the Chinese name Great Jin. He intended to wear royal robes and ride in a jade-encrusted carriage, and incidentally, he wanted Liao to pay an annual tribute, almost as large as the tribute the Song paid to them. The Liao resisted, and the Jurchen attacked. With short-sighted enthusiasm, the Song Emperor Huizong agreed to make an alliance with the Jurchen against the old northern Liao enemy. Song Huizong was not a military man. He had been on the throne since 1100 and spent much less time governing than he did building Taoist temples, endowing Taoist monasteries, and studying Taoist teachings. In this, he was encouraged by the flattery of a self-centered Taoist priest named Lin Lingsu, who assured the emperor that he was the incarnation of the supreme deity, great imperial lord of long life. This convinced Huizong that he was indeed a son of heaven, possessor of the divine mandate, and he occupied his days with painting, poetry, tea ceremonies, and Taoist rituals. He was swayed into the alliance with the Jurchen when Akuta promised that after the joint conquest of the Liao, the Song could reclaim the southern reaches of the old Liao Empire. This land had once been the Chinese 16 prefectures, and it had been in enemy hands for a century. Retaking the prefectures would shore up the divine mandate with a real display of victory. So Huizong sent his army to help conquer the Liao, paying no mind to the expanding power of the Jurchen themselves. In 1122, the combined armies reached the Liao capital and took the emperor captive. The remains of the Liao army and 100,000 refugees fled west, away from the conquerors. But the Jurchen refused to hand over the 16 prefectures. Akuta had died and had been succeeded by his young brother, who took the Chinese name Jin Taizong. But probably neither brother had ever intended to follow through on the promise. Instead, the Jurchen marched into Song territory, heading for the Song capital of Kaifeng. Under Song Huizong's rule, the carefully built system of trained local militia had fallen to bits, and the Jurchen broke through the Song defenses with little difficulty. By the end of 1125, they had crossed the Yellow River and were in sight of the city. Song Huizong, jolted out of his overconfidence, tried to escape from responsibility for the looming defeat by faking a stroke, abdicating, and ordering the royal robes placed on his heir, his 25-year-old son, Qin Zong. Qin Zong refused to take on the thankless job. When the robes were draped on his shoulders, he pushed them off and told his father that to accept them would be disloyal and unfilial. Huizong, who was pretending that his right side was paralyzed, wrote a message with his left hand, ordering his son to take up the mandate. He still strongly declined, says one account, so Huizong ordered the eunuchs to forcibly carry him to Blessed Tranquility Hall and put him on the throne. Ginzong was definitely unwilling to walk, so the eunuchs forcibly carried him. He struggled with them and passed out from holding his breath. After he recovered, they resumed carrying him to the western chamber of Blessed Tranquility Hall, where the grand councillors met and congratulated him. The Jurchen carried out their conquest of Kaifeng over several stages, demanding tribute, withdrawing, returning and demanding hostages, withdrawing. But by 1127, the game was over. The city was no longer able to hold out, and the Jurchen stormed its walls and began to steal treasure, food, animals, and women. Song Ginzong, whose reign had not been one of courageous nobility, rounded up the daughters of the common people so that the Jurchen would rape them first, but the invaders soon broke into the houses of the nobility as well. The city was looted, burned, and then placed under enemy rule. Both Song Ginzong and his father were captured and taken, along with scores of other prisoners, back to the north. Huizong died in prison not long afterwards, but Ginzong lived for the next 3 decades in captivity. The Song era was over. Refugees from the Song court fled their city, taking with them Ginzong's younger half-brother, Gao Zong. They proclaimed him emperor in exile at Lin'an, far to the south. The Song had ended. The dynasty that would rule in the south for the next century was called the Southern Song, but it was only a weak remnant of previous glories. Author's note: the Song dynasty is sometimes known as the Northern Song, to differentiate it from the Southern Song. This can be misleading, since the Northern Song controlled both the Northern and Southern territories, so I have chosen to use simply Song for the dynasty that existed before 1127. Even worse, the northern land that now lay in Jurchen hands was the cradle of Chinese culture, the valley where the most honoured of its divine kings had lived, the home of the great deeds that had made the ancient Chinese Empire the envy of its nomadic neighbours. The poems of the Southern Song are filled with longing for the abandoned lands. I see their forts amid the forest when I gaze toward the Yellow River. The cloud of dust darkens the sky, and the frost wind is bitter. The silence of the border regions rends my heart, wrote the poet Zhang Xiaoqiang. The beacon fires have been extinguished, the soldiers given rest, yet I have heard that the old who are left behind in the central plains constantly look toward the south, hoping to see the decorated imperial chariots. But the chariots never came. The Southern Song still claimed the mandate of heaven, but it had lost its physical connection to the place where the mandate first descended. The history of the ancient emperors lay in the valley of the Yellow River. Now that valley was in enemy hands. Chapter 82. Repentance at Canossa. Between 1060 and 1076, Henry IV refuses to obey the Pope, gets himself excommunicated, and is forced to stand barefoot in the snow, pleading for mercy. In 1060, the Capetian king of Western Francia died, and left his crown to his 7-year-old son Philip, a child incapable of halting the tide of private warfare that still surged back and forth across the Frankish lands. Woe to thee, O land, when thy king is a child, contemporary chroniclers wrote, using the words of the Book of Ecclesiastes to lament the disorders in the old Frankish lands. In Germany, another underaged king ruled, Henry IV, now 10 years old. His mother, who would rather have been a nun than the queen and regent for her son, avoided trouble with the noblemen of Germany by granting them power, and they ruled over their little independent duchies with the prickly defensiveness of minor kings. Right after Easter of 1062, the German archbishop, Anno II, with the support of 2 powerful German counts, invited the young king to come and inspect a ship that had been outfitted particularly for his use. As soon as Henry stepped on board, the oarsmen cast off and whisked him away down the Rhine. The king had been kidnapped. 12-year-old Henry dove into the river in an attempt to escape, but the water was cold and swift, and he nearly drowned before one of the conspirators dragged him back out. They took him to the city of Cologne, imprisoned him safely and in luxury in Anno's palatial archbishop's residence, and took over the rule of Germany. For 3 years, until Henry IV turned 15 and could promise royal aid and support to anyone who might help him get his independence back, the archbishop and his henchmen struggled with each other for control of the country and of the king. Henry watched, waiting for his majority, becoming stronger, more mature, and more ruthless as the months ticked by. No overarching rule of law could settle the wars between the Christian and Muslim armies farther east, but there was one institution that could appeal to all of the battling ambitious parties laying waste to the countryside. Despite the political meddling of a few of its more ambitious officials, the Christian Church still preached its message of Christian brotherhood and loyalty to a kingdom not of the earth. The Christian Church still claimed the loyalty of all kings and soldiers in the West. In 1063, priests in the northern German city of Terouan put together another set of regulations for the peace and truce of God. These are the conditions which you must observe during the time of the peace, which is commonly called the truce of God, the document began, which begins with sunset on Wednesday and lasts until sunrise on Monday. During those 4 days and 5 nights, no man or woman shall assault, wound, or slay another, or attack, seize, or destroy a castle, burg, or villa by craft or by violence. Furthermore, the peace would be observed during every day of Advent and Lent, as well as between the church feasts of Ascension and Pentecost, a schedule that made nearly 3/4 of the year off-limits for fighting. This was a lovely idea, but impractical, not to mention almost impossible, to enforce. Still, the Peace of Terouan brought into clearer view a growing tension in the kingdoms of the West between the ideals of the kingdom of God and the kingdom of men, between the power of priests to enforce Christian behavior and the power of kings and warriors to do as they pleased. It was a tension that became fully visible when Henry IV tired of his wife. He had been betrothed, at the age of 5, to the 4-year-old Berta of Turin, daughter of a prominent Italian nobleman. The marriage was celebrated when Henry IV turned 15, against Henry's own objections. He had never liked his intended wife, who seems to have been attractive enough but too shy and demure to appeal to the forceful adolescent Henry had become. Still, when Henry's advisers warned him that he might cause irreparable offence and damage to his prospects in Italy by cancelling the wedding, the king decided to go ahead. By 1069, he had concluded that his marriage was a mistake. He announced that he intended to seek a divorce from Berta because he was simply unable to consummate the marriage. In an act of slightly overdue gallantry, he added that she was in no way at fault, which didn't ease her humiliation, but at least protected her from accusations of adultery. The churchmen of Germany, putting their heads together, decided that this was too complicated a problem for them to rule on, and sent the request to Rome. There, Pope Alexander II absolutely refused to release Henry IV from his vows. "One who betrays the Christian faith by setting so pestilential an example," he sent back by way of a special papal messenger, "will never be consecrated emperor." The Church of Rome had transferred its expectations of protection from the German king to the Normans of Italy, but the Pope did not intend to give up his right to choose the next Holy Roman Emperor. Henry IV, only 18, backed down. He withdrew his request for a divorce, and in the next years Berta bore him a son and a daughter. But the sting of public reproof lingered, and Henry, who had been trained by a turbulent adolescence to be forceful and uncompromising in demanding his own rights, did not forget that his will had been crossed. In 1073, Alexander II died, and the College of Cardinals elected a brilliant and severe archdeacon to replace him, Gregory VII, who came to the papacy determined to protect it from corruption and from reliance on swords and kings. He was deeply, irrevocably opposed to the idea that a layman, no matter how royal, could appoint any church official. That, he argued, was an act that would inevitably lead to corruption, to the sale of church offices, and to the domination of the emperor over St. Peter's heir. His view of his own God-given authority is laid starkly out in 27 statements that he put down on paper in March of 1075. "The Pope alone," he wrote, "could appoint and remove bishops, call church councils, and authorize new church laws." The Church of Rome had never erred, and never will err till the end of time, and as its leader, the Pope also had the right to depose emperors. All princes, he concluded, should kiss his feet. This was not an attractive idea to Henry IV, but since the beginning of Gregory VII's tenure, Henry had been preoccupied with putting down a serious rebellion in the Duchy of Saxony. But by the autumn of 1075, he had managed to temporarily suppress the revolt. This gave him time to consider Gregory's increasing power in Italy, which he reacted to in deed rather than word. He appointed new bishops to the bishoprics of Milan, Fermo, and Spoleto, taking for himself the exact authority that Gregory had claimed in his Dictatus Papae. Gregory's reaction was measured and careful, and shows at least some hope that Henry IV would reconsider. In late December of 1075, he wrote the king a letter, offering to approve the royally chosen Bishop of Milan and suggesting a roundabout and face-saving way for Henry IV to acknowledge his spiritual authority. The king should send away from his German court 5 of his advisers who had been excommunicated for their involvement in selling church offices. Faithful members of the Christian church were not supposed to associate with unrepentant sinners who had been excommunicated. Henry's willingness to exile these men would acknowledge that Gregory was still his spiritual father. A later account, written by Gregory himself, says that the Pope sent this restrained letter by way of 3 papal envoys, who were given the job of delivering a much stronger verbal message. These men secretly admonished him to do penance for his sins, and threatened that if he did not yield to the authority of the divine laws, he should not only be excommunicated until he had made due satisfaction, but that he should also be deprived of his entire dignity as king without hope of recovery. Henry IV did not react well to threats, even private ones. In response, he summoned the excommunicated advisers and, on their counsel, convened an assembly of his court, several of the most powerful German princes, and 2/3 of the German bishops. The council met in the city of Worms in January of 1076, less than a month after Gregory VII's warning, and under Henry's direction agreed that 2 different letters should be written over the king's signature. One, sent to Rome, accused Gregory VII of seizing the papacy without due election, trampling on the rights of the bishops and, as an extra touch, seducing an Italian noblewoman named Matilda. "Your accession was vitiated by gross perjuries," the letter read. "The Church of God is exposed to the peril of severe storms by your misdeeds. You have besmirched your life and conduct by manifold disgrace. Accordingly, we renounce an obedience that we never promised you and will never show you." The second letter was longer, even more tabloid-like in its details, and circulated through Germany as a bit of royal propaganda, justifying Henry's defiance of the Pope. "Henry, King by the grace of God, to Hildebrand," the letter began, using Gregory VII's birth name and refusing to address him by the official name he had taken when he became Pope. "By your evil scheming you have sought to prise away from me the Italian kingdom. You dared to rise up against me, the head, putting upon record what you very well know, to use your own words, that either you would die or else you would strip me of my soul and of my kingdom. Every right to the papacy that you seem to have, I deny you. From the bishopric of the city whose patriciate is rightly mine by God's gift and by the sworn agreement of the Romans, I say, step down." Gregory received the letter intended for Rome in mid-February of 1076. He and Henry IV were alike in one thing. He too disliked threats. On February 22nd, he announced that, by the authority of St. Peter himself, the king was no longer part of the Christian Church, an act with serious implications for Henry's secular power. "I absolve all Christians from the bond of any oath that they have made or shall make to him," he announced, "and I forbid anyone to serve him as king." Henry IV had overplayed his hand. With this official permission, the noblemen of Saxony, who had just barely been beaten into submission when the argument between king and pope broke out, once more rebelled. This time, Henry IV was unable to overcome them. Many of the German aristocrats who had supported him in the last revolt were too nervous over Gregory VII's declaration to throw their weight behind the king this time around. By October of 1076, Henry IV could see that 2 choices lay in front of him. He could make amends with Gregory VII, or suffer through years of civil war, which might well end in his forced removal from the throne. The king chose immediate embarrassment over long, drawn-out humiliation. He collected his household, his wife Bertha, and his 2-year-old son and heir Conrad, and with them began a penitential journey south through the Alps. The weather in the mountains crashed in on them. It was January, according to some chroniclers the worst winter in 100 years, and the paths were covered with ice and snow. "Sometimes they crawled forwards on hands and feet," one account tells us. "Sometimes they supported themselves on their guides, and sometimes, when they slipped on the icy ground, they fell a good way." The horses were lowered with special machinery, or else dragged along with their legs tied together. In spite of this, many were killed on the descent. Gregory VII, getting wind of the king's approach, thought that he was coming with an army and retreated to the fortress of Canossa, which had 3 walls around it. But when Henry IV appeared, it was as a penitent begging forgiveness. Gregory's own letter describing the king's approach says that he was barefoot, wearing sackcloth and weeping, and that his self-humiliation moved everyone in the fortress. He provoked all who were there to such great mercy and pitying compassion that they interceded for him with many pleadings and tears, the Pope wrote. Indeed, some complained that we were showing not the strictness of apostolic authority, but a cruelty that was reminiscent of a tyrant's inhumanity. Forced to forgive Henry IV as much by public pressure as by his own inclinations, Gregory VII agreed to restore the king's good standing. In return, Henry promised to recognize the Pope's authority and to give up the practice of appointing his own bishops. A great reconciliation banquet followed. Henry sat at the table, silent and withdrawn, refusing to eat and drumming on the table with his fingers. He had managed to keep his crown, but his decision to repent had made one thing perfectly clear to the entire Western world. When earthly and spiritual rulers clashed, earthly authority was the first to buckle. Chapter 83. The Call. Between 1071 and 1095, the Turks take Jerusalem away from the Fatimids of Egypt. Henry IV forces the Pope to crown him Holy Roman Emperor. The Emperor Alexius asks for help driving back the Turks, and Pope Urban II summons a crusade. The Emperor of Constantinople was facing a combination of Turkish attack and domestic revolt, both less theologically complicated than Henry IV's problems, but equally damaging to royal power. Romanos IV's defeat at the Battle of Manzikert was matched in the same year by defeats in Italy. In 1071, while the Byzantine army struggled in Asia Minor, Robert Guiscard and his Normans had conquered the last Byzantine strongholds in Italy. The Empire of Constantinople now lay up against the Black Sea, pushed into smaller and smaller territory by the expanding kingdoms of the West and the swelling Turkish power in the East. The new senior emperor, Michael VII, was bookish and self-absorbed and paid little attention. "Nothing pleased him more than reading books," writes his tutor Michael Psellus with approval, but other chroniclers were less impressed. While he spent his time on the useless pursuit of eloquence and wasted his energy on the composition of iambic and anapaestic verse, and they were very poor efforts indeed, scoffed John Skylitzes, he brought his empire to ruin. In 1074, Michael VII's uncle, John Ducas, led a rebellion against him. It was only quelled when Michael's general, Alexius Comnenus, hired soldiers from the Seljuk Turks to beef up the spare troops still loyal to the crowned emperor. This required Byzantium to come to some sort of treaty with the Turks, which was a dangerous act indeed. In 1073, Alp Arslan had been murdered by a prisoner he was interrogating, and his rule over the Turks went to his son Malik Shah. Malik Shah, only 18, began his sultanate with Ghaznavid strong on his east, the Sultan of Rum chafing for independence to the west, and Fatimid power reviving itself to the south. After losing the north of Syria to the Turks in 1070, the Fatimid Caliphate in Egypt, which had been badly weakened by a six-year famine and mismanagement, had slowly begun to revive itself under the leadership of a general named Badr al-Jamali, who took control of the government in the name of the caliph and imposed a military dictatorship. Malik Shah fought hard to keep the Seljuk Sultanate strong, and in most ways was triumphant. Necessity had forced Constantinople to suspend hostilities against the Turks. Now Malik Shah threatened and tamed the Sultan of Rum into temporary loyalty and reinforced the Ghaznavid border. Turkish armies, under the command of the general Aziz ibn Abak, pushed south all the way to Jerusalem, which up until now had been in the hands of the Fatimids of Egypt. Aziz and his soldiers laid siege to Jerusalem and forced the Fatimid defenders to surrender in 1073. Fatimid resistance in the city continued until 1077, but in that year, Aziz grew exasperated and massacred 3,000 of its inhabitants, mostly Fatimid Arabs and Jews. This brought a final end to the Fatimid attempts to hold on to the city. It was now firmly under Malik Shah's overlordship. In Constantinople, Michael VII was less successful. The army in Asia Minor grew exasperated with his weakness and proclaimed their general, Nikephoros Botaniates, emperor at the city of Nicaea. Nikephoros marched towards Constantinople, and Michael VII, realizing that he could not muster enough support to resist the army, promptly abdicated and entered a monastery. He left his wife, Maria, behind, and when Nikephoros Botaniates arrived in the city, he married Maria and was crowned emperor as Nikephoros III. This brought only more trouble, and it was trouble that stretched all the way west to Italy. Before his abdication, Michael VII had promised his four-year-old son, Constantine, in marriage to the daughter of the Norman adventurer Robert Guiscard, also known as Robert the Fox. This had been a desperate attempt by Michael VII to keep Guiscard from sailing east and attacking more Byzantine land after he had finished capturing the Byzantine territory in Italy. At the same time, Michael VII had put a large army under the command of his general Alexius Comnenus, the same general who had defeated his uncle John Ducas on his behalf, to prepare for a possible Norman invasion. Now, against the wishes of his new wife, Nikephoros III disinherited her son and broke the betrothal to Guiscard's daughter. Guiscard immediately began to gear up for a massive invasion in revenge, while the Empress Maria, distraught over her son's removal from the succession, appealed to the general Alexius to come and restore the little boy's rights. Alexius Comnenus was at this point a vigorous soldier of 30, the most powerful man in the empire, and Nikephoros III, decades older, had counted on his support. When Alexius instead accepted Maria's invitation and turned towards Constantinople, Nikephoros imitated his predecessor. He abdicated as soon as possible and got himself to a monastery before Alexius could enter the city with his soldiers. In 1081, Alexius was crowned Emperor of Constantinople. Less than a year later, Nikephoros died of old age in his monastery bed. Alexius Comnenus kept faith with Maria and restored Constantine's position as co-emperor, but, ignoring Robert Guiscard's threats, he did not restore the Norman betrothal. Instead, he engaged his own young daughter Anna to the little boy, ensuring the succession for both Constantine and the Comnenus family. This began a two-year war between the Normans of Italy, under Robert Guiscard's command, and the Byzantine army. "It was love of power that inspired Robert and never let him rest," wrote Alexius's daughter Anna, who served as her father's biographer. Anna is hardly an impartial witness, but there is no question that Guiscard hoped to add all of Byzantium to his empire. When he arrived at the Byzantine border, he had with him a monk who claimed to be the deposed Michael VII. In Constantinople, it was widely believed that the man was an impostor, but Guiscard's attacks continued. Alexius knew that the empire was almost at its last gasp, Anna tells us. The east was being horribly ravaged by the Turks, the west was in a bad condition, while Robert strained every nerve to put on the throne the pseudo-Michael who had taken refuge with him. Alexius was an intelligent commander, but the Norman army was stronger. It pushed steadily forward into Byzantine territory. At the same time, Malik Shah was threatening to invade from the other side. Alexius needed help, and he turned to Henry IV of Germany. Henry IV had spent the years between 1077 and 1081 putting down another revolt in Saxony. The Duke of Swabia, Rudolf, had managed to get himself declared rival king by the German aristocrats in Saxony and Bavaria. 3 years of civil war between king and anti-king had followed. At first, Pope Gregory VII had announced his neutrality in the fight, but by 1080, Gregory VII had decided that Rudolf would be a better German king, much more likely to yield ultimate control of the church to the Pope. At the celebration of Easter, he again excommunicated Henry IV and announced that Rudolf was the rightful king of Germany. This decision was so clearly political in nature that most of the German bishops, even those who had sided with the Pope during the last clash with Henry IV, rejected the excommunication as unlawful. So did a number of the Italian bishops. In May of 1080, right after the Easter excommunication, Henry IV called his own synod. The loyal bishops called on Gregory VII to step down and elected the Italian Archbishop Wibert of Ravenna to be Pope in his place. Henry IV planned to march down to Rome and install Wibert in St. Peter's seat by force, but first he had to finish the civil war in his own kingdom. On October 14th, his army was defeated by the rebels in Saxony, but in the fighting, Rudolf was severely wounded, his right hand cut off. 2 days later, he died from his injuries, and the revolt against Henry IV fell apart. Henry spent a few more months mopping up the resistance, months that Robert Guiscard spent ravaging the Byzantine countryside. Desperate to rid himself of the Normans so that he could turn around and deal with the Turks, Alexius sent messengers to Henry IV, requesting him to move his army into Italy sooner rather than later. Henry's invasion would force Robert to go back home and defend his Italian territory. "Although in other respects my affairs go well," the emperor wrote to the German king, "to a very small degree they are in disarray and confusion because of the actions of Robert." The casual wording was belied by the rest of the message. Alexius offered Henry IV the massive sum of 360,000 gold pieces to support the Italian campaign. Henry IV accepted, and in March of 1081 crossed over into Italy. Between 1081 and 1082, he attacked Rome three times, failing to breach the walls, but coming closer and closer to conquest each time. Gregory VII sent desperate appeals to Robert Guiscard, over in Byzantium, but Guiscard was reluctant to abandon his invasion. In his absence, Henry IV finally broke into the city of St. Peter. He entered Rome in June of 1083. Gregory VII walled himself up in a fortress on the west bank of the Tiber with his remaining supporters. For nearly a year, Henry IV worked to earn the loyalty of the Roman people, distributing gold liberally and slowly winning Gregory's followers over to his side. By March of 1084, he was able to convince the Roman priests to support him in deposing Gregory. On Palm Sunday, March 24th, Wibert was proclaimed the new pope. A week later, on Easter Sunday, he crowned Henry IV as Holy Roman Emperor. Author's note: Wibert took the papal name Clement III, but is generally referred to as anti-pope Clement III, since the later pope, Paolino Scolari, also took the name Clement III, 1187 to 1191. Henry was 34 years old, and had spent nearly 20 years working towards this moment. Now Robert Guiscard finally and reluctantly returned to Italy, leaving his son Bohemund in charge of the Byzantine War. Henry IV heard of his approach and decided not to fight him. He and Wibert of Ravenna left Rome on May 21st, 3 days before Guiscard's arrival. Guiscard marched into the city as a deliverer, and was instead forced to put down an immediate rebellion against his return, which he did with a fair amount of savagery. This restored the city to his control, but it made him so hated that he decided to retreat to the Norman lands in Italy, taking Gregory VII with him. The Pope never returned to Rome. He died in 1085, on his deathbed absolving everyone he had excommunicated during his lifetime, except Henry the so-called King and the Archbishop of Ravenna. Robert Guiscard, preparing to sail back to Byzantium, his son Bohemund had immediately started losing battles, died from a fever 2 months later. He was 70 years old and left behind a reputation for conquest that lasted for centuries. 200 years later, the poet Dante placed him in the sphere of Mars, along with Charlemagne and other great commanders, and wrote of the Byzantine soldiers who felt the thrust of painful blows when they fought hard against Robert Guiscard, whose bones are still piled up at Separano. With Guiscard's death, the serious threat to the western borders of Byzantium came to an end. But the Turkish threat to the east continued. Malik Shah's armies conquered Antioch, removing it from Byzantine control, and then pushed steadily into Asia Minor. As the Turks spread into Muslim land, they gradually adopted Islam. In the last years of his reign, Malik Shah converted to the Shiite branch of the faith, the final step in making the Turks into a Muslim people. His death in 1092 did not bring an end to the Turkish threat, but it changed the Turkish alliance into a series of independent states. He left behind 4 sons and an ambitious brother, and as they fought over Malik Shah's domain, they fractured into pieces. The Sultanate of Rum broke free under Malik Shah's former vassal, Kilij Arslan. Syria, Persia, Kirman, southern Persia, and Khorasan all separated from each other, each declaring itself a sovereign Turkish realm. Seeing the opportunity to get back some of his conquered land in Asia Minor, Alexius Comnenus sent another message west, seeking more help for Byzantium. His old ally Henry IV was having difficulties. He was still king of Germany and Holy Roman Emperor, but the Lombards of northern Italy had rebelled against him, perhaps resenting the constant war Henry's feud with the Pope had inflicted on them. Henry IV's declining power in Italy meant that his hand-picked Pope, Wibert of Ravenna, had also suffered from loss of authority. A new pope, Urban II, had been elevated in Rome in 1088. Henry IV had no energy to spare for Constantinople, and Wibert of Ravenna had no power, so Alexius sent his envoys to Urban II instead. They asked the pope to send Italian soldiers east to help Alexius push back the Turkish invasion. This was a relatively simple request. Alexius needed mercenaries, but Urban II transformed it into something new. He was on a tour through Italy and western Francia, designed to demonstrate that the Pope's authority, unlike the fractured authority of his predecessors, once again covered all of the Christian world. Now he would demonstrate that the authority of St. Peter's heir stretched across the world. In November of 1095, at Clermont in western Francia, Urban II announced that it was not only time to help Byzantium in its battles against the Turks, as Alexius had asked, but also time to recapture Jerusalem from the hands of Muslims, something Alexius had not mentioned. "As most of you have heard," he announced, according to the Frankish chronicler, Fulcher of Chartres, "the Turks and Arabs have occupied more and more of the lands of those Christians and have overcome them in 7 battles. They have killed and captured many, and have destroyed the churches and devastated the empire. If you permit them to continue thus for a while with impunity, the faithful of God will be much more widely attacked by them. On this account, I, or rather the Lord, beseech you as Christ's heralds to publish this everywhere and to persuade all people of whatever rank, foot soldiers and knights, poor and rich, to carry aid promptly to those Christians and to destroy that vile race from the lands of our friends. I say this to those who are present. It is meant also for those who are absent. Moreover, Christ commands it." All the Frankish noblemen who had been chafing under the restrictions of the peace and truce of God could now have something useful to do with their energy. "Let those who have been accustomed unjustly to wage private warfare against the faithful now go against the infidels," Urban II told his audience. "Let those who for a long time have been robbers now become knights. Let those who have been fighting against their brothers and relatives now fight in a proper way against the barbarians. Let those who go not put off their journey. As soon as winter is over and spring comes, let them eagerly set out on the way with God as their guide. Those who eagerly set out would receive the greatest possible reward. All who die by the way, whether by land or by sea, or in battle against the pagans, shall have immediate remission of sins," Urban promised. After the struggle of the last 2 decades, Peter's heir had finally reasserted his authority not only over the earthly world, but over the afterlife as well. Chapter 84. Fighting for Jerusalem. Between 1095 and 1099, Christian warriors from the west set out on the First Crusade. "As soon as winter is over and spring is come," Pope Urban had told his audience, so in the cold months of late 1095 and early 1096, the quarrelsome aristocracy began to prepare for the journey east. The hope of heaven inspired many, but the chance to earn renown propelled others. "The first to sell his land and set out on the road to Jerusalem was Godfrey," writes Anna Komnena, "a very rich man, extremely proud of his noble birth, his own courage, and the glory of his family." Godfrey was a German nobleman, the Duke of Lower Lorraine. He was accompanied on crusade by his brothers Baldwin and Eustace, and the 3 siblings were followed in rapid succession by Robert Guiscard's son Bohemond, who left his father's Norman lands in Italy to answer the call with a smaller army. The Frankish Duke Raymond of Toulouse, who brought 10,000 men with him, and Robert, the Duke of Normandy. Robert, oldest son of William the Conqueror, had inherited Normandy at his father's death in 1087, while his younger brother William had become the 2nd Norman King of England. Scores of others travelled towards Constantinople, discreet bands of armed men all converging on a single point. The first to arrive, according to the 12th century account of William of Tyre, Walter the Penniless, who, as his name suggests, was a Frankish nobleman too poor to hire a large army for himself. He was travelling through the old kingdom of Bulgaria in the early summer of 1096, when a small band of men, unpaid and starving, began to steal from the villages they passed. The Bulgarians retaliated by driving some of the robbers into a nearby church and setting it on fire. It was an unfortunate start to the First Crusade. Walter the Penniless arrived at Constantinople in mid-July with his remaining men, and was given lodging by the Emperor Alexius while they waited for the more prosperous dukes and their larger armies to arrive. The next army to arrive at Constantinople was a force of some thousands. Contemporary accounts say 40,000 men or more, but are probably exaggerated, led by a cleric nicknamed Peter the Little. On an earlier pilgrimage to Jerusalem, Peter had suffered much ill-treatment at the hands of the Turks. He had returned to preach across the Frankish countryside that all should depart from their homes and strive to liberate Jerusalem, and when Urban II had pronounced exactly the same message, Peter the Little had been delirious with joy. Later chroniclers would call Peter's army the People's Crusade, as though it were made up of farmers and housewives. In fact, it had a full complement of soldiers. It just lacked high-profile aristocrats, who preferred to lead their own private armies. Peter and his troops arrived at Constantinople around August and were welcomed in turn by the emperor, who then suggested that they move on across the Bosphorus Strait and camp near the Byzantine frontier while they awaited the rest of the crusader armies. Alexius was not anxious to add thousands of restless armed men to the population of Constantinople. The two forces, waiting in temporary quarters about 25 miles from the Turkish-held city of Nicaea, were soon joined by other random arrivals, bands of soldiers without experienced, forceful leadership. Bored crusaders, meeting no serious opposition, raided the Turkish countryside, and the mood of the camp shifted towards aggression. Before long, the entire leaderless force marched out and headed for Nicaea. The Sultan of Rum, Kilij Arslan, sent a detachment of his army out to swat the flies. Of the 25,000 foot soldiers and 500 knights who had gone forth from the camp, writes William of Tyre, there remained scarcely one who escaped either death or capture. Walter the Penniless was killed. Peter the Little escaped across the strait and begged the emperor for help. Alexius sent a Byzantine detachment back across the water, and the Turkish army, which was marching towards the camp to annihilate the rest of the ill-organized crusader force, sloped off and went back home. At this point, Alexius was probably wondering what he had gotten himself into, but the arrival of the disciplined private armies of Bohemund, Raymond, and the others throughout the winter of 1096 to 1097 reassured him. However, the emperor had gotten a taste of the headstrong crusader mindset. He took precautions. As each duke arrived, Alexius asked him to swear an oath that whatever cities, countries, or forts he might in future subdue, which had in the first place belonged to the Roman Empire, he would hand over to the officer appointed by the emperor. This first crusade, Alexius reminded them, was to be fought for the benefit of Byzantium, not for personal gain. In the spring of 1097, the united crusader forces poured across the straits into the Sultanate of Rum. They laid siege to Nicaea in mid-May and forced the city surrender before the end of June. Accompanied by Byzantine troops under the command of Alexius's trusted general, Tatisius, the crusader army then marched southwards towards the city of Jerusalem. One at a time, the Turkish-held cities fell to them: Smyrna, Ephesus, Philadelphia, Sardis. The victories came to an abrupt halt at the city of Antioch. With Godfrey, Bohemund, and Raymond of Toulouse in the lead, the crusaders laid siege to the city on October 2nd. Antioch was the strongest city in Syria. Its ancient walls touched the Orontes River, allowing the defenders a constant supply of water and an easy way to resupply the city with food and arms, and the crusaders, although victorious, were weary from months of fighting. Most of them had never seen Antioch before, and they were unpleasantly startled by the city's defences. "We found the city of Antioch very extensive," the Frankish nobleman Stephen of Blois wrote to his wife, "fortified with incredible strength and almost impregnable." The siege dragged on, and the nights began to grow colder. By December, the army had stripped the surrounding countryside bare of food and fuel. Provisions dwindled away. A party sent out to forage for food farther away encountered a Turkish detachment, which drove them back empty-handed. The horses, unaccustomed to such poor rations, were dying off. By January, fewer than 2,000 mounts were left of the 70,000 that had started off from Nicaea. "Day by day the famine grew," writes William of Tyre. In addition, the pavilions and tents in the camp had rotted. Thus, many who still had food perished because they could not endure the rigors of cold without protection. Floods of water fell in torrents, so that both food and garments molded, and there was not a dry place where the pilgrims might lay their heads. Pestilence broke out among the legions in the camp, so fatal that now there was scarcely room to bury the dead. Peter the Little, who had accompanied the army this far, deserted and tried to go home. He was hauled back by one of the captains, who forced him to swear that he would remain. In February, the Byzantine general Tatisius yanked his men from camp and headed back towards Constantinople. Rumors of an approaching Muslim army disturbed the soldiers who remained. The possibility that the whole crusade might fall apart at Antioch was growing ever more real. The city itself was in better shape than the camp. The contemporary Muslim account, written by the Syrian chronicler Ibn al-Qalanisi, remarks that so much oil, salt, and other necessities were sent to Antioch by way of the river that it was actually cheaper to buy those staples in the besieged city than outside it. Meanwhile, crusaders who had already abandoned the cause were prospering. Godfrey's younger brother Baldwin had veered away from the main crusader army and gone to the independent city of Edessa, where the city's king had first employed him as a mercenary and then adopted him as son and heir. Stephen of Blois had announced that ill health required him to leave, and had gone with his men to more comfortable quarters on the Mediterranean coast. On March 4th, the Crusader outlook took a slight upswing when an English fleet docked on the Mediterranean coast about 10 miles from the siege camp. The fleet had stopped at Constantinople for reprovisioning, and the Emperor Alexius had ordered siege materials, tools, and workmen loaded onto the ships to be taken to Antioch. The fleet was commanded by none other than Edgar Atheling, the heir to the English throne who had surrendered to William the Conqueror at age 14. Now in his 30s, Edgar Atheling had already joined at least 2 failed wars. He had gone to Scotland in his late teens and had fought with the Scots in a fruitless rebellion against William the Conqueror, and 10 years after that had joined a short-lived revolt against William's son and heir. Now he was anchored on the Mediterranean shore, ready to aid in the conquest of Antioch. Raymond of Toulouse and Bohemond went together to bring the siege materials back to the camp. The Crusaders built additional fortifications that blocked ships from refreshing Antioch supplies from the river, and the city began to weaken. At last, the defenders inside Antioch started to lose heart. Bohemond, who had a reputation for craftiness, habitual rogue, Anna Komnena calls him, managed to talk one of the Turkish guards inside the city into a private deal. Bohemond sent word that he would make him rich, with much honour, says the chronicle known as Gesta Francorum, and the guard yielded to these words and promises, saying, "At whatever hour he wishes, I will receive him." In the dark night of June 2nd, Bohemond's informant opened a postern gate, and Bohemond led his men into the city. They killed the guards at the large gate known as the Gate of the Bridge, and threw it open from the inside. The rest of the Crusader army flooded into Antioch. The frustration of the long siege burst out of them. The victors roamed at will through places formerly inaccessible to them, writes William of Tyre, and maddened by lust of killing and greed for grain, they spared neither sex nor condition and paid no attention to age. More than 10,000 citizens were slain that day. Along the streets, everywhere, the corpses of the dead lay unburied. But despite the victory, the Crusader army was soon in horrible straits. An enormous Muslim army, commanded by the Turkish general Kerboga, had been dispatched by the great Sultan of the Turks in Baghdad, and it arrived at Antioch just 3 days later. The Crusaders swung the city's gates closed and gave thanks that they were not still in the siege camp outside, but they soon discovered that conditions inside the city were much worse than outside. Antioch was already empty of food. Now it was stinking with corpses as well. Disease spread. The Crusaders were reduced to digging up dead animals that had been buried weeks before, so that they could eat the rotting flesh. In a desperate attempt to rally the Crusaders, Bohemond, a supreme mischief-maker, Anna Komnena adds, announced that God had sent a message of assurance and deliverance. It had come, he explained, to the peasant Peter Bartholomew, who was part of Raymond of Toulouse's entourage. The Holy Lance, the spear that had pierced the side of Jesus Christ during the crucifixion, was inside the city. Peter Bartholomew had told the story to Raymond and to the Bishop Adhemar, who had accompanied the army of Toulouse as a representative of the Pope, and Raymond had believed him. Adhemar, on the other hand, had called the story nothing but words. However, he was willing to see whether the lance would actually be discovered. Bohemond took Peter Bartholomew, Raymond of Toulouse, and a handful of men into the Church of St. Peter at Antioch, where they dug a pit in the place that Peter Bartholomew indicated. The pit was empty. Raymond of Toulouse, dejected, left the church, at which point Peter Bartholomew leaped into the pit and then climbed back out, clutching the point of a spear. Raymond of Toulouse, a devout and honest man, apparently judged others by the yardstick he used to measure himself. He immediately embraced the discovery as genuine, and the Bishop Adhemar apparently chose to hold his tongue. The word spread through the Crusader army, which took heart at this evidence of God's favour. On June 28, 1098, the Crusaders charged out of Antioch with the Holy Lance in their midst and drove the Muslim army into retreat. Antioch was now in Crusader hands, but the city was never turned over to the Emperor Alexius. Bohemond had sworn the oath without ever intending to keep it. Now he claimed that since the surrender of the city had been arranged by him personally, the city had surrendered to him and was now his. He intended to stay in Antioch as its prince. In this, he was following the example of Godfrey's younger brother Baldwin, who had now inherited the rule of Edessa and was governing it as an independent Christian state. The the county of Edessa. Bohemund would be prince of Antioch, ruler of a Christian kingdom in Syria. Raymond of Toulouse disagreed with him sharply, and the two men quarreled. In the end, Raymond separated himself from the decision to keep Antioch and left the city. He paid both Robert of Normandy, who was broke by this time, and Bohemond's own nephew Tancred in gold to accompany him. Eventually, Godfrey and his men also followed Raymond from Antioch. Bohemond remained, flying his own flag above Antioch's walls. The remaining crusaders, led by Raymond of Toulouse, marched towards Jerusalem. Over 50,000 men had crossed the Bosphorus Strait into Asia Minor at the beginning of the crusade. Now fewer than 14,000 remained. Following the army was a throng of pilgrims who had been hoping to reach the Holy City for almost 3 years now. A helpless throng, William of Tyre says, sick and feeble. On the way, the leading noblemen in the army had demanded that Peter Bartholomew prove his claim to divine revelation. They forced him to undergo an ordeal by fire, walking through flame with the holy lance in his hand. Bartholomew had apparently begun to believe his own story. He was dreadfully burned and died after 12 days of agony, and the story of the holy lance quietly faded away. The crusaders continued on towards Jerusalem. For a good cause, they could cope with being exhausted, outnumbered, sick, and hungry, but they objected to being manipulated. The crusader army arrived at Jerusalem in early June of 1099. There they found a landscape as forbidding as Antioch's. The summer days were hot, and water was scarce. The Turks had plenty of time to stop up the springs and foul the wells near the city, so that the crusader army would have nothing to drink. Trees, buildings, and all possible sources of timber near the city walls had been levelled. The pack animals, deprived of water, died, and a pestilential stench rose from their decaying bodies. But Jerusalem itself did not possess Antioch's frightening defences, and the crusaders set doggedly to work. A siege camp was established around Jerusalem, and parties were sent far afield looking for wood. The attack on Jerusalem began on June 13th. For 3 weeks, the crusaders battered the walls with ineffective siege machines built from twigs and brush. When a fresh detachment of crusaders arrived by sea, Raymond of Toulouse directed that their ships be hauled aground and broken up for their wood. The siege towers built from the water-soaked timbers were rolled towards Jerusalem's walls. Under cover of crusader arrow fire, the northern moat was filled in. The siege towers were pushed over the newly laid dirt. The fighters in the siege engines had set on fire sacks of straw and cushions stuffed with cotton, William of Tyre explains. Fanned into a blaze by the north wind, these poured forth such dense smoke into the city that those who were trying to defend the wall could scarcely open their mouths or eyes. Bewildered and dazed by the torrent of black smoke, they abandoned the defense of the ramparts. The attackers lowered wooden bridges to the tops of the walls and stormed across them into the city. Antioch had taken 7 months to conquer, Jerusalem barely 30 days. Another massacre followed. So terrible was the shedding of blood that even the victors experienced sensations of horror and loathing, says William of Tyre. No mercy was shown to anyone, and the whole place was flooded with the blood of the victims. Everywhere lay fragments of human bodies. Survivors were pulled from alleys, from closets, from cellars, and were killed by the sword or hurled from the walls. The slaughter was in part the explosion of nearly 2 years of pent-up frustration with the heat, famine, disease, and misery of siege camps. In part, it was a calculated strategy to wipe out every trace of opposition. News had reached the crusaders that a Fatimid army was on its way from Egypt. The Fatimids, driven from Jerusalem by the Turks, were launching an attack to take it back. By the time the Fatimids arrived at Jerusalem's wall on August 12th, the city was completely under crusader control. Godfrey led the crusader army out from the city's wall and drove the Egyptian army back without too much difficulty. The Egyptians retreated without mounting a second attack. Jerusalem had been taken. The goal of the first crusade had been accomplished. Three Christian states, ruled by crusader nobles, now dotted the Muslim East: the county of Edessa, the principality of Antioch, and the kingdom of Jerusalem. Raymond of Toulouse was the obvious choice to rule the conquered city of Jerusalem. Unlike Antioch, Jerusalem had not been a Byzantine city before its conquest by the Turks, so there was no obligation to hand it back to Alexius. But Raymond declined to accept the title of king. The slaughter had left a poor taste in his mouth. He probably hoped to be offered the job again with another title, perhaps that of count or governor. But like many good men, He was not particularly popular, and the second offer never came. Instead, Godfrey was offered the position and accepted it, ruling Jerusalem as its duke and protector. Chapter 85. Aftershocks. Between 1118 and 1129, the ideal of crusade is written into law. In Spain, Alfonso the Battler had been fighting for 2 decades against the Muslim Almoravids. This, as far as he was concerned, was also holy war. Recapturing Spain for Aragon-Navarre meant recapturing it for Christ, and it had been a long, hard fight, complicated by his ongoing feud with his wife. In 1118, a church council at Toulouse decreed that the capture of Zaragoza, the northernmost kingdom in the Almoravid realm, could be considered a crusade. This meant that helping to drive the Almoravid occupiers out of Zaragoza would be a righteous act, an accession of grace. One French account says that the Pope himself promised forgiveness of sins to those willing to besiege the city. Alfonso had been trying to capture Zaragoza for at least 4 years. The additional energy provided by the council finally tipped the balance. Noblemen from the south of Western Francia brought their private armies to help out, and the realm fell to the Christian armies in the fall of 1118. The energies of the First Crusade had spilled across the West all the way into Spain, and had shifted the balance of power back towards the Christian kings. The Almoravid power in Spain began to diminish. The Almoravid ruler, Ali ibn Yusuf, remained in Marrakesh. He treated Spain like a distant outpost, and the Almoravid soldiers stationed there were less and less inclined to fight to the death to keep their land. Meanwhile, Alfonso the Battler wrote the crusader status of his Christian armies into church law by founding a series of military orders. Soldiers who joined them earned the status of monks, full-time servants of God. The Confraternity of Belchite was formed in 1122 to defend one particular area south of the Ebro River. Having been touched by divine grace, Alfonso the Battler announced in the Order's Charter, "We have established through our imperial authority a Christian knighthood and a brotherly army of Christians in Christ in Spain at the castle which is called Belchite, so that they may serve God there, and thereafter, for all the days of their lives, subdue the pagans." Several other orders of Christian knights followed, all devoted to keeping the Almoravids out of conquered territory. At the same time, military orders were springing up in the east. The first and most powerful began in Jerusalem, where Godfrey had governed the city for barely a year before dying of typhoid. The Frankish crusader still in Jerusalem had invited his brother Baldwin of Edessa to come and be crowned as the King of Jerusalem. This was a step up from Count of Edessa, so Baldwin handed Edessa over to a distant cousin, also named Baldwin, and made his way to Jerusalem. He fought a series of battles over the next 18 years and expanded the kingdom of Jerusalem well past the city's borders. When he died in 1118, the same distant cousin who governed Edessa was crowned King Baldwin II of Jerusalem. Now that the city was no longer in Turkish hands, more Christian pilgrims came to visit it, but all three crusader states were in a constant state of war, and the journey was a perilous one. In 1119, the Frankish nobleman Hugh of Payen came to Jerusalem, searching for a way to better his soul. He decided that protecting pilgrims who were travelling unarmed from the coast to the city was a righteous mission, and over the next few years he recruited like-minded men to help him. "They lived as monks, not taking a wife," wrote the 12th century patriarch of Antioch, Michael the Syrian, "not bathing, having no personal possessions whatsoever, but having everything in common. Like monks, they took vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Unlike monks, they carried arms." Their services were so greatly appreciated by travellers to Jerusalem that King Baldwin II decided to make provision for them. "He granted them a temporary dwelling place in his own palace," says William of Tyre, "on the north side by the Temple of the Lord." They took their name, the Knights Templar, from this dwelling place. Author's note: although the Crusaders and their chroniclers often speak of the Temple, the Jewish Temple destroyed in AD 70 had not been rebuilt. Temple sometimes refers to the mosque near the Dome of the Rock, and sometimes to the dome itself. In January 1129, Hugh of Payen travelled to the Church Council of Troyes to request formal recognition of his monastic order. The assembled churchmen approved of the order's purpose, and the great monastic reformer, Bernard of Clairvaux, took it upon himself to write the order's rule. His rule for the Knights Templar begins, I exhort you who, up until now, have embraced a secular knighthood in favour of humans only, and in which Christ was not the cause, to haste to associate yourself in perpetuity with the order. In this, the order of knighthood, which, despising love of justice, did not strive to defend the poor or churches, which was its duty, but to rob, despoil, and kill, has flowered again and revived. This was exactly what Pope Urban II had hoped for, the redirection of violence into the paths of righteousness. The founding of the military orders was the closing act in the drama begun by Constantine at the Milvian Bridge. Marching into Rome under the banner of the cross, he had taken a powerful and mysterious theology and bent it to his own purposes. It had promised unity. He needed unification. It had promised ultimate victory. He needed earthly victory at once. It had promised an identity that transcended nationality and language. He had needed to overcome nationalism. Most of all, he needed to convince his soldiers, the people of Rome, and the enemies who threatened him, that he was driven by something higher and more noble than simple ambition. Probably he needed to convince himself as well. Christianity gave Constantine freedom from guilt over his conquests, at the same time that it lent him the zeal he needed to pursue them. 700 years later, the military orders did exactly the same things for the men who joined them, and gave them a rule to spell out precisely what they would gain. That marriage of spiritual gain and political power would shape the next 5 centuries, and the painful and protracted divorce between the two, the centuries after that. This concludes the history of the medieval world. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers, or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalogue.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.